KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's forum, we talk to Marin County-based poet Kay Ryan, who was named the 16th Poet Laureate of the United States. National Endowment of the Arts Chair Dana Gioia compares Kay Ryan to Emily Dickinson and describes her verse as, quote, thoughtful, bemused, effective, end quote, and the work of a deeply skeptical outsider. And Yale English professor and Poet Voice Series editor J.D. McClatchy says her verse is, quote, as intense and elliptical as Dickinson, as buoyant and rueful as Frost, end of quote. Kay Ryan joins us next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Kay Ryan was recently named 16th Poet Laureate of the United States. She has lived for years in Fairfax in Marin County, taught remedial English at the College of Marin for a number of decades. She's also built a formidable body of work as a poet, including 6 books of poetry, and her poems have been published regularly in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, and The New York Review of Books. She grew up in what she once described as the glamour-free zone of Central California, living in small towns throughout the San Joaquin Valley and Mojave Desert, and she has described herself as a modern hermit. She won the Ruth Lilly $100,000 Poetry Prize in 2004, was a Guggenheim Fellow, as well as a 3-time Pushcart Prize winner and a recipient of the Maurice English Poetry Award. And she joins us for this forum hour, and as I told her, I'm delighted with you being the Poet Laureate. It's nice when things happen to people whose work I admire and whom I admire. We last saw each other in New York at a book party that was given to me by my publisher, Stanford Press, and it was a memorable party.
It was a great party.
It was a good party. And now you're going to be having parties all the time because you're so celebrated.
Oh, I hope not.
For somebody who describes yourself as a hermit, to be the Poet Laureate, the crown
There's
weighs heavy,
wrong.
Doesn't
There's
it?
Yeah. Something wrong there, isn't there?
Well, what want to
I
talk
mean, was
about.
I wrong about myself, or am I wrong about myself now? Who knows?
Well, you're just going to be compelled into morphing in different ways that you probably hadn't expected. I was reading some of the things you said about what you would do as Poet Laureate. You said, keep bad poetry from being published. That means we have to keep the stuffed owl from being printed. Since it's the Library of Congress that named you Poet Laureate, you got to issue more library cards, right? Actually, what do you plan to do? You're going to follow through with like what Hass was doing and all that, work with all these kids and stuff?
Since I just got these laurels, I'm really hoping to see how it feels to just rest on them, you know, just kind of recline and rotate my body on a lot of laurels. Now, actually, to tell you the truth, I just don't know yet what I might do. I might do something, and then again, I might just...
Retreat?
Retreat. I might ride my bicycle a lot. I don't know.
Well, congratulations. And speaking about riding your bicycle, I want people to know, because they may not know this about Kay Ryan, that she rode her bicycle from California to Virginia in 80 days and did it with a feeling, especially going through the Colorado Rockies, of no boundaries. That was kind of epiphany the time for you, wasn't it, in some ways?
Yeah, I blush to say so, but it was sort of an epiphany. I undertook the ride, which was on the occasion of the bicentennial, and the route was the bike centennial route, and it was set up specifically for this occasion. It went through the little towns and on the back roads of America, and I was trying to decide whether or not I was going to, in a sense, accept my calling. I mean, it all sounds so religious and grand, and it was something that I was trying to avoid doing. I didn't really want to be a poet, but I thought I would have plenty of time on this ride to figure out if I was going to be able to avoid it or if I was going to do it. And when I was riding up the Hoosier Pass, which is like a 13,000-foot pass in the Colorado Rockies with, you know, all my camping gear and everything, I'd gone through several states without getting any message from the gods. And when I was going up this pass, I suddenly did enter a kind of a condition of no boundaries. And I had a terrific sense of mental acceleration, which I fooled around with a little bit like you would with a stunt kite. And then I realized, ooh, this won't last forever. Let's ask the question. So I asked, whatever I asked, I don't know, shall I be a writer? And the answer was one that I really couldn't fight with, because it was just this question, do you like it? And the deep truth was that I did like it. I liked it better than anything.
So the fear of being a writer, or what kept you from being a writer, and you were, I think, rejected at UCLA from the poetry club.
Yeah, yeah, I was in my early years.
But you didn't want to be a writer because of the exposure mainly, right?
Yeah, I didn't want to be a writer because of the exposure, and because I was just embarrassed by the sort of the posture of the Byronic poet. I came from a people who were anti-drama, you know, simple Danish folk. My father was a well driller.
You mean you thought if you became a poet, you'd have to wear a cape like Byron?
I just thought, and you know, also this was in the 70s when poetry was extremely autobiographical, and it involved an awful lot of body fluids and things that didn't really attract me to write about.
This is what Garrison Keillor said is unfortunately called confessional poetry.
Yes, I think that's the word I was searching for, yeah.
And
I had no desire to confess in that way.
Well, your poetry is not necessarily all that confessional. I mean, it certainly brings your inner life out, but it's not on that level of what the stuff that was going on in the 70s. I mean, think of Robert Lowell or Sylvia Plath, right, or even Anne Sexton. Tarot cards also played a role in this epiphany, though, didn't they?
Yeah, I want to go back to one thing about confession or non-confession. I mean, what I ultimately realized was that we are utterly exposed, whatever we do. You know, we really are, to anybody paying attention. We are exposed and can't avoid it. But we can avoid certain kinds of showing off, I think. Back to the Tarot. When I came back from this bicycle ride, I knew I was going to write. But I didn't know how to go about it. And I had a deck of Tarot cards. They were also very popular, but I didn't have the patience to learn how to read them. So I just set them out in this elaborate way suggested by the Tarot manual that accompanied the cards, and I'd turn one over every morning, and I set myself the project of writing about whatever came up, which might be love, which would be something I would have recoiled about, against writing about, or death, or the Hierophant. I mean, what is a Hierophant?
Well, it's secret.
And so anyhow. I would continue until I'd written as many poems as there were tarot cards, and if the same card kept coming up, I would have to just deal with that topic again and again. So that was an interesting exercise in making myself deal with a lot of different themes that I might not have otherwise.
So if you work with kids like Bob Haas did when he was Poet Laureate, you're going to work with a tarot deck too?
You know, I'm not going to work with kids. I never teach poetry. I never have.
In fact, you've taught remedial English.
I've been in the trenches, yes. Yeah. I've dug a few.
And still feel committed to it, don't you?
Well, I think it's noble work. I admire the people who do it. I admire the students. I think it's absolutely necessary. There's an increasing need all the time for basic skills in the colleges.
I told a story last night. The writer Raymond Carver, who I'm a great admirer of, also a poet as well as a storyteller, came to UC Berkeley, and they said, we're going to take, by that time had his laurels, and they were going to take him and introduce him to the graduate class studying American literature and his work. And he said, I prefer to meet the students in the remedial English class, because,
like,
of course,
that.
He felt more connected to them.
Yeah. Yeah,
and you feel connected to your
students. I do. Students can reach the level where they can educate themselves, and I like them. I like them. I think when they still need the class and are glad to be there, you can get into a lot of rather artificial situations in more advanced literature classes.
Talking to Kay Ryan, the new Poet Laureate of the United States, who met her life partner teaching at Quentin, Carol Adair. And the story is, tell me if I have it right, that you were married at City Hall back in 2004, then went through the second marriage, and were told on the day of your second marriage that you had won, that you had been conferred, that you had been...
Yeah, how do you say it?
That you had been given the coronation of Poet Laureate, whatever.
That's really true. The entire thing. We did meet at San Quentin. Carol Adair was the first woman working in the education program at San Quentin. I came along sometime later as a teacher from College of Marin. Part-time teachers were sort of rotated out there periodically. And we did get married in 2004. We stood all night in the rain with the other couples, the line snaking around City Hall. And it was absolutely glorious. It was a terrific experience. And then, of course, that was only a citywide marriage. And now we've enjoyed a statewide union as of earlier this month. And yes, I found out on the very same day that I was going to be the poet laureate, and we'd already decided to get married that day. I was just popping. I couldn't tell anybody, though. I was sworn to secrecy. It's Carol and I. Well, I told Carol, and we were both just bursting.
It's an extraordinary high, I imagine.
It was.
I
mean, really was.
Almost ineffable. Can you write a poem about it?
You know, I never write about anything that actually happens.
Well, that gets us into your poetry. What a nice segue. No, seriously, because you once said you want your poems to be almost like an empty suitcase. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know those clown suitcases that you know, the clown opens the suitcase there and just keeps pulling stuff out of this essentially empty suitcase. I want my poems to not have very much in them, but when you start pulling it out, it just keeps coming out. So, or like the clown car, too, you know, where 1,000 clowns can come out of one car.
Well, in fact, I was reading an article in the New York Times by Patricia Cohen, and she said, she described your style as sly, and she said, and I certainly echo these sentiments as a reader of yours for many years now, that you are funny and philosophical. And I think in some ways, you know, you move us into a different realm than a lot of poetry, because some of your poetry can be so wry and so magical that it takes us, it takes me away from myself in some good, I mean that in a very positive sense, but also surprises. And you want a surprise. It's like that clown metaphor again, isn't it?
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. And maybe we can get a sampling of, I'll have to twist her arm, of course, to get Kay Ryan to read. No, but you got a new collection, right?
Well, I have a 2005 collection, which is The Niagara River.
That was your last volume.
Yeah.
And maybe we can read from that. But I just wanted to also say that your poetry has also been described, I mentioned Dickinson and Frost, who are names that one often hears you liken to, but lightness and substance that evaporates. Mm. Like that? Does that seem apt to you?
I like it.
Yeah. What do you want to read to us?
Well, you know, you'd mentioned to me wanting to hear Turtle.
I love that poem.
So I might as well start with that. This takes us back to the mid-90s. To provide just a little bit of autobiographical framework, which you would never know and certainly don't need to know, but hey, we're on radio, you can find out. This was written during a time when I was finding it extremely difficult to have work taken. And nearly a decade passed between the previous book and this book that the poem shows up in, which is Flamingo Watching. And so this turtle, this frustrated turtle, is very much me. That's the truth. And I was so frustrated that I think it lent this terrific compression of sound devices and shifting imagery, its intensity. My mind was just like mouse traps with really light triggers. It just, everything set it off into this poem. Turtle. Who would be a turtle who could help it? A barely mobile hard roll, a four-oared helmet. She can ill afford the chances she must take in rowing toward the grasses that she eats. Her track is graceless, like dragging a packing case places, and almost any slope defeats her modest hopes. Even being practical, she's often stuck up to the axle on her way to something edible. With everything optimal, she skirts the ditch which would convert her shell into a serving dish. She lives below luck level, never imagining some lottery will change her load of pottery to wings. Her only levity is patience, the sport of truly chastened things.
Yeah, I love that last two lines especially.
Thank you. I would like to point out...
You're out of your shell
if
now,
I
though,
mind.
Aren't
yeah,
you?
I'm way out of my shell. I'm beyond my comfort zone.
You want to point out...
I wanted to point out my favorite, I think it's my greatest rhyme ever. It says, you know, the turtle is described as a barely mobile hard roll, a four-oared helmet. I would like to point out that a four-oared repeats in the next line, she can ill afford.
Oh, yeah.
Afford is a four-oared,
yes,
you know?
Yes, yes.
Isn't that funny?
It was involuntary or...
I don't even know. Yeah. I'm not sure I even knew it when I did it. I mean, I probably did, but then I looked back and went, wow, that's pretty amazing.
I also thought when I mean, here's your humor again. She often stuck up to the axle on her way. Makes you think of, just the word axle sort of sounds a little bit like stuck up to, well, anyway.
It's like a car. But yeah. One thing I would like to say is that I find rhyme extremely generative, and probably how I got to that word axle, she's up stuck up to the axle, was from even being practical. You know, practical probably suggested axle to me, which in turn made me say with everything optimal. So, you know, all those things just link together and get someplace I couldn't have gotten to
otherwise. It's sound, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. Sound, you know, when you were a kid, well, I lived where the ground was really hot and in Bakersfield, say, and we would be barefoot and try to get someplace, and we'd throw a piece of cardboard out in front of us. We'd have several pieces, and then we'd go jump on it, throw another one out, grab that one up. So in a way, the rhymes kind of are like something thrown ahead of me that lets me go farther, but I didn't know where I was going till I had that rhyme.
What a splendid metaphor for your poetry, the metaphor being the childhood play of it.
Well, I guess that's an element, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as you just described, want to read something else for us?
Sure. I thought I would read something from the Niagara River. This is called Felix Crow, and it's a little poem. Well, it's partly any point my saying little poem. They're all little. They're kind of snack-sized poems.
And this was published in Poetry back in 2004, yeah?
Oh, good. I'd forgotten that.
Yeah.
Anyhow, here we go. I have a complex relationship with crows, and this kind of expresses it. Felix Crow. Crow school is basic and short, as a rule. Just the rudiments of quid pro quo for most students. Then each lives out his unenlightened span, adding his bit of blight to the collected history of pushing out the sweeter species. Briefly swaggering the swagger of his aggravating ancestors down my street. And every time, I like him when we meet.
it's just delightful. There's also, there's so much embedded in that little poem. It does remind me of Dickinson. I mean, whom you're often... Why the name Felix, though?
Well, I wish my name were Felix Crow. I just think that's a great name. Happy Crow?
Like Felicity. Yeah. Felix, right.
I don't know. I just like it. And well, he is a happy crow.
Old sticks upon to scare a bird. Think about Yeats and all that Morden stuff about crows, right? What do we got out? What else do we have?
Well, you want me to read another poem? I'll read it. I'll read one that's only half as long as this one. This is called Atlas. And I want you, when I read this, I want you to have the classic image of Atlas
with the globe
down there holding up the globe. Mm-hmm. I want you to have that picture in your head.
Among School Children, by the way, was the Yeats poem. Sorry, I wanted to reference that. Go ahead.
Atlas. Extreme exertion isolates a person from help. Discovered Atlas. Once a certain shoulder-to-burden ratio collapses, there is so little others can do. They can't lend a hand with Brazil and not stand on Peru.
Well, you've got a sampling of K. Ryan's work, and I should mention that her books include The Niagara River, which was published in 2005, also Say Uncle, Elephant Rocks, Flamingo Watching, and so glad that you're our new poet laureate.
Thank you.
Let me open up our phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us. You can do that now, in fact, toll free from wherever you're listening to Forum or however, radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's your available phone line, and it's available to you, and it's 866-733-6786. You can join us with any questions or comments you might have. We're also going to talk about poetry, of course, with Kay Ryan. And poetry has been going through all kinds of changes. I think last time that she was with us, we talked about slam poetry and how poetry has mutated and morphed and metamorphosed in so many different ways. You may have some comments on that, or you may simply want to talk to Kay Ryan and let us know what you think about what you've heard here this morning, or if you know her poetry and have some thoughts and reactions to it. Feel free to join us. Well-known poet in the Bay Area for many years now, and now named by the Library of Congress as U.S. Poet Laureate. Our phone lines, again, are available, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum at kqed.org, and we'll try to get your emails on the air here as well. I was looking at a book by Camille Paglia, which you probably know, Break, Blow, Burn. In fact, we talked with her about it on the air. It's all about poetry, and she says, "For me, poetry is speech-based and is not just an arbitrary pattern of signs that can be slid around like a jigsaw puzzle. I sound out poems silently as others pray. Poetry, which began as song, is music drama. I value emotional expressiveness, musical phrasings, and choreographic assertion, the speaker's theatrical self-positioning toward other persons or implacable external forces." It kind of says it pretty well, doesn't it?
Well, in a lot of words, yeah.
Yeah, could be
if
more
you like
precise.
A lot of words.
I mentioned at the beginning of the program you live in Fairfax. It's such an unusual place, isn't it?
Well, I'm quite accustomed to it after 30 years, but it is a very special place.
It is a special place. Talk about that a little bit. I mean, does it influence your work?
You know, it's so hard to say if one doesn't have a control self someplace else, seeing how she's doing, you know? I mean, is the K. Ryan in New York City doing something different? I don't know. I don't have one. I would say that it allows me a lot of peace, a lot of quiet. It gives me wonderful hills to run and bicycle in. It gives me congenial company and a gorgeous atmosphere, great weather.
We're going to have to go to break here in just a second, but I had a question that you can satiate my curiosity that I've always wanted to ask, and that is, how did one of your poems get installed in the Central Park Zoo?
Well, it was part of a project. I think it was Poets House, and it was part of a project to put poems in the zoo. And mine certainly isn't the only one. I'm the only one who's made a big fuss over it, maybe because I was so thrilled. It's on a retaining wall. And little children can run all over it.
And what's the title of the poem?
It's called How Birds Sing.
It's in the aviary type of bird
sanctuary? It's right outside the big pool where the sea lions are. It's right outside
there.
It's
been a long time since I've been there. But
it's great.
Yeah. Makes me think of Paul Simon's song, you know, at the zoo. Well, we're going to come back with Kay Ryan, and we'll get her to read some more in the next half hour. We'll also take your phone calls. And this is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Kay Ryan, who is the new Poet Laureate of the United States, talking a little bit off air about, again, a little passage I read from Camille Paglia, Kay said she could have said it more succinctly, which is certainly true, but about the sound of poetry, though, and how you hear your poems, don't you?
I really do. As a matter of fact, I hear everything. When I'm a very slow reader because I... What do they say? Subarticulate. I have to hear everything, and if I come to a name I can't pronounce, I have to figure out how to pronounce it before I can go on reading. So yes, I do hear my poems, and I mean to write them in such a way so that that the person who's reading them will hear them also. I really mean for the reader to inside the theater of her own skull to be able to hear this poem in her own voice. And I want to make sure there are enough cues so that she can do that really well. I think that poetry, if it isn't thought of as something that you're hearing, it's missing really one of its major dimensions. And by saying that, I don't mean to suggest that I'm terribly fond of hearing poetry aloud, because I'm really not. I only want to hear poetry I already love aloud. And otherwise, I really want to read it myself and see what's there, because an awful lot slides by. It isn't really very good. It's just going on kind of the slide of the skilled voice.
Do you sometimes, when you read your poems, hear the poem in a way that enlightens you or illuminates you in ways that you hadn't thought before when you were not reading the poem or just reading it in your head?
Yeah, I do, especially I find sound connections. You know, I might find a word that has an extra dimension. Like, you know, like in Felix Krull, which I just read.
I thought of Felix Krull, the Thomas Mann novel.
Oh, Felix, yes, right.
Yeah,
right.
No, but
that's not what I'm getting at, although that's interesting. Yeah. But I say in there, just it says that they don't have, the crows aren't very schooled, just the rudiments for most students. And I thought how fun it was to have the word rude in there. In relationship to crows, because I'm saying that they're very rude, obnoxious creatures.
Heckle and Jekyll, if you remember
yeah,
that?
Sure, yeah, I do. Sure. Yeah.
In fact, there's a black licorice called Black Crows, you know, which comes to mind for some strange reason. I mean, it's just amazing kind of the imagery you get.
Crows are really,
like that, yeah,
really important bird.
Yeah. Let's go to our callers, and we'll start with you, Leslie. Good morning.
Good morning. I actually would like to go back to the potential job of the Poet Laureate and what you said about keeping bad poetry from being published, which I realize is probably a tongue-in-cheek remark, but at the same time, there is some relationship between quality and the learning process, and I'd like to hear you speak about that a little bit. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the call.
Well, I'm going to have to try to figure out what you mean, Leslie. Do you mean that that people need to be educated more in order to write better, or what? I think that I would probably like to just sweep this under the carpet and say that I was truly making a joke when I said that I would reduce bad poetry, because the problem really is nobody can decide what it is. I think if I'm going to take a politic position here, I better be more on the side of promoting the finest poetry.
But, you know, it's important for a lot of educators to get kids to write poetry, young people, and it's, you know, terrific for them to express themselves, but some of it really is putrid and really bad poetry, and it's difficult to say that because it comes out of sometimes a very private place or self or life.
You know. It's really easy to tell somebody, you know, you really aren't a brain surgeon, you know, so even though they've practiced on the weekend to be a brain surgeon. But it's very difficult to tell someone who practices on the weekend to be a poet, that, you know, it really takes a great deal more than this casual engagement. Even though these are your genuine sentiments, it doesn't make it good.
There you go. Additional callers here. Betty, hi.
Hello.
Morning.
Am I on?
You are on.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for having me on. I'm also an instructor in a community college, actually at Case College, and wanted to first say I was thrilled, of course, that she was chosen for this prestigious position. But I also want everyone to hear that Kay, with all her skills, has been teaching remedial English for all these years, and which I have always, it's always intrigued me that someone of her great skills would be doing it. And I want to know, Kay, I heard you this morning say that you don't teach poetry in your remedial English class, but how do you reach your students? How do you use your skills in poetry and your outlook on life to reach these students?
Well, that's a very good question. It's true, I don't ever teach creative writing. I've always taught remedial English. I have to admit that I'm not teaching it this semester. But I think I could say that one of the most essential things for all teachers, and I'll bet everybody's going to agree with me, is that you have to develop the ability to create analogies. You have got to move a student from a condition of not understanding something to understanding it, and you'll use anything you can, their skateboard, any kind of analogy that you could possibly make to bring them across. And I think over the course of a zillion years, I've really refined and simplified my my skill with metaphor making. And I think that teaching remedial English has been a big gift for me. It's made me a better writer.
Let me thank Betty for her call. Do you do a lot of nuts and bolts in remedial English? I mean, I would presume you have to. It's always been the case with composition, at least. I mean, that is just sentence-level kind of problems.
Yeah, I always taught at the level where we were aspiring to the paragraph. I mean, a really handsome paragraph with a good topic sentence, good support, good grammar.
Can a paragraph be gorgeous and lovely as well as handsome?
Oh, certainly.
Handsome makes me think gender. Yeah. You know.
Well, what does lovely and gorgeous make you think? It makes you think gender also, the other way.
Yes, exactly the point. Let me get to more calls here. We'll go to Foster City. Margaret, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling just to make a comment. I heard Kay Ryan read a poem about her mother, and the poem described, after her mother died, it described her mother's life and some of the daily routines of her mom, and it was a beautiful poem, and it reminded me a lot of my grandmother. And after she read it, Kay Ryan said that her mother's life was a simple life, and she hadn't left much of a mark on the world. But I just wanted to say that she left Kay Ryan, which is a great mark on the world.
Very kind and nice call. Thank you for that. Do you know the poem she's talking about? Would you want to
sure.
read it?
Sure. I'll read it. Yeah. It's kind of uncharacteristic of me because it really is much more. There's a person walking around in this poem, and that's pretty rare for me. It's called Things Shouldn't Be So Hard. And by the time you get to the end of the poem, you understand the title in an opposite way than you are assuming right now. A life should leave deep tracks. Ruts where she went out and back to get the mail or move the hose around the yard. Where she used to stand before the sink, a worn-out place. Beneath her hand, the china knobs rubbed down to white pastilles. The switch she used to feel for in the dark, almost erased. Her things should keep her marks. The passage of a life should show. It should abrade. And when life stops, a certain space, however small, should be left scarred by the grand and damaging parade. Things shouldn't be so hard.
Very nice. That's also from the Niagara River, we should mention. The title of the Niagara River?
Right.
No, I mean, tell us about that.
Oh! Sorry
to be cryptic.
The title, The Niagara River,
is a poem. Yeah.
But and I will read that poem.
Why don't you?
But first I'll tell you why I called it The Niagara River. I wanted to suggest in the reader's mind before she read this poem something that isn't said. If I say The Niagara River, it causes you to think about the more famous aspect of that waterway.
The falls.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to say the falls ever. And you'll see why. As though the river were a floor, we position our table and chairs upon it, eat, and have conversation. As it moves along, we notice, as calmly as though dining room paintings were being replaced, the changing scenes along the shore. We do know, this is the Niagara River. But it is hard to remember what that means.
Again, the images that come to my mind, you know, they used to be people who did barrels over Niagara Falls. I mean, they would go in a barrel and try to
right.
get over the falls. And Joyce Carol Oates wrote a whole novel about Niagara Falls, in fact. Let's get Mariah on here next. Hi, Mariah.
Hi. Congratulations, Kay.
Thank you.
I'm getting married on Sunday to a fabulous man who is a fan of your work, and I was wondering if you would read a love poem, a marriage poem, however you interpret that, as a blessing for both of us. It would be an honor.
Well, you know, I have one that has been used at weddings, and it's called plain ordinary steel needle. My problem is that I have to look at it for oh, got it. Now, I was just astonished when I found out that this had been used for weddings, but I can really see it. It will depend on how literary you and your celebrants are. This is called a plain ordinary steel needle can float on pure water, and that epigraph comes from Ripley's Believe It or Not. And you know, of course, that is possible. Many, many children have made that happen. Okay, so here's the poem. Who hasn't seen a plain ordinary steel needle float serene on water as if lying on a pillow? The water cuddles up like jello. It's a treat to see water so rubbery, a needle so peaceful, the point encased in the tenderest dimple. It seems so simple when things or people have modified each other's qualities somewhat. We almost forget the oddity of that.
Bravo. Well, I hope those of you who are listening this hour are luxuriating in and enjoying Kay Ryan's poetry as much as I am. Here's a listener who says, will Kay Ryan be reading anywhere soon or this year soon? I suppose she means locally, or he means locally. Also, can you mention a couple of poets who have influenced you?
The answer to the first question, I have a few little dates around that were made before this great bomb went off in the middle of my life, and I don't even recall where or when. I'm going to be reading at the National Book Festival in Washington, D.C. in late September, and then I'm opening the poetry series at the Library of Congress on the 16th of October. So those are kind of vivid dates in
here
my memory.
Here at home, though?
Here at home, I know I have something coming up with Litquake.
Litquake. Yeah, I saw your name on that. Yeah.
And so I'm sure I'll be at Litquake.
That's the Chronicle's big literary event that's put on every year. Here's Mark, who says, I've read a lot of Kay's poetry and listened to her read and talk on numerous occasions. I'm hearing a brighter tone in her voice as she talks today. She sounds happier, lighter, which certainly must be true given the recent events in her life. Comment?
Do you think so? I don't know. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's pretty exciting to be named Poet Laureate.
Should be euphoric. Yeah. We've got a little patch of this country, with Bob Hass and you. I mean, two Northern Californians who have been Poet Laureate. In fact, I think even when Pinsky was named Poet Laureate, the FDR of Poet Laureates, as I call him, he was at Berkeley at the time, I think, teaching, wasn't he?
So I don't know.
There's a real Northern California connection. Here's Lee, who writes, here's something our new Poet Laureate could tackle if she's serious about stopping bad poetry. Start a campaign to put good poetry back into public school textbooks. As Diane Ravitch points out in her book, The Language Police, both right and left-wing zealots have succeeded in forcing textbook publishers and state textbook selection committees to select poetry and other literature by only two criteria, removal of anything that offends anyone, and I mean anyone, and comfortable with the zealot social indoctrination policies. The quality of the poetry has become irrelevant. The result is generations of students emerging from our schools hating poetry because everything they were exposed to was unreadable, intellectual sawdust. I think that's rather overstated, to put it mildly, but there's a lot of bad poetry out there, as you've suggested.
Well, I'm just going to say I happen to know a wonderful and long available anthology of poetry, and that's the Introduction to Poetry, X.J. Kennedy's volume.
Yes.
And Dana Gioia was the co-editor of that for years, and I think he may be the editor, but that is filled with rich, varied, and utterly teachable, delicious poetry.
Well, the Norton Anthology of Poetry,
oh,
actually.
Of course.
It's a wonderful volume.
I'm sorry and disheartened to think that there's sawdusty stuff out there, but there are wonderful anthologies. Certainly that Kennedy Gioia one is great.
And we go to more of your calls. James, join us. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. John Skelton and Henry VIII started laureating a long time ago. Do you have an opinion of the tradition? Has it changed since you got on the other side of the window? Sometimes my academic friends went to become academic poets, places like, say, Smith or other fancy places, and it didn't do him any favors. What do you think?
Well, I'm kind of the school that our poets are generally going to be off in some little corner of North Dakota or some place that we don't expect, rather than at the places where they're identified.
Like a leper colony or something?
No, they'll always be alone. I think, at least my sense is that they'll be off perfecting their craft by themselves. I think it's pretty dangerous to get the opinions of others when you're too vulnerable. I think you should only suffer others' opinions when you're really strong and can stand it.
There is a whole tradition, though, of the poet laureate. I mean, you know, I think of Tennyson, and you think of so many of the great British poet laureates.
Well, the British laureates have a really hard row to hoe. It's a lifetime appointment, I believe. Here, it's just a year, or, you know, they give you another year for bad behavior.
Yeah, what heavy is the head that wears these crowns, I think. I mean, it's even here in California, Al Young was named poet laureate of the state of California, and this is a kind of a regal position in some ways as well.
Well, you know what I had to remind myself in agreeing to take this position is I can't really represent poetry. I'm only one, and I can barely represent myself. I think if I can generalize about anything about poetry, I can say that poetry doesn't want to generalize.
Well, you're sui generis, but not only as a poet. Dare I say that? No, I mean, seriously, you are very much your own person. And it's going to be interesting to see how this all falls into place for you this year. Yeah.
Well, I have to remind myself that I was invited for the work that I had done. Right. The appointment is made for the one who has done a body of work that is being recognized. Mm-hmm. So it isn't really for the likelihood that I will enact a useful social program, although that would be very nice too. But I have to remind myself that it does have something to do with poetry in the long run.
Yeah, it's the poetry, stupid. The Clinton, it's the economy, stupid.
I'd like to believe it.
A caller from Fairfax. Dan, hi.
Hi there. First of all, I wanted to congratulate Ms. Ryan on this award. I'm not a poet reader, but maybe I'll become one. There was another thing I wanted to mention. Earlier, she said that she wasn't really in love with listening to poetry being spoken, but I sure enjoyed listening to her read the three or four that she's done so far this morning. And one last statement was I liked the poem Atlas. Was that at all politically motivated when you put it together?
No, and thank you for your compliment. No, it wasn't. I almost never respond to anything political, but the happy thing is that if you write clearly, the work can apply to a lot of things that haven't occurred yet. It can be really uncanny, in fact, how work can apply.
You believe, I think it goes back to Shelley, but Auden also used the phrase, you know, the unacknowledged legislators, that poets are the unacknowledged legislators. Puts you in a very political context, that kind of.
Well, I mean, the language is there. I don't think one can shape anything willfully. But the language is there to be used or misused, really, if you think about it.
Let's go to more calls. Janelle, do I have your name pronounced right?
Yeah, Janelle, that's right.
Hi.
Kay, I just want to say congratulations.
Thank
to you. And I also want to say that I think it's wonderful you working with remedial students. It's very powerful. Sorry. I come from a background of special ed classes, and I always felt that literature and language moved me and inspired me. I still write poetry, but it was very hard where I didn't feel like I belonged, and I think it's great the way you're going about it.
I'm so glad for your call. I am very, very glad to think that this is gratifying to you. I would like to remind everyone that there are students at every level who are just as full of human beings and just as able, but they're at a different level of knowledge of English. And it a lot of times we get a little snobby about where literature is, and I know that live language is everywhere.
Thank you, Janelle. Appreciate your call. This is Dalid from Oakland. Good morning.
Hi. It's actually Dalid.
Dalid, sorry.
No problem. I'm actually really glad that you took my call right now. My call is about, I'd like to ask Kay about how she feels about slam poetry, which is specifically performative. I think it was Lawrence Ferlinghetti that called it the death of poetry. A lot of other folks have credited with the resurgence of spoken word and poetry in general. Organizations like Youth Speaks, which deal with a lot of kids, you actually had Robert Redford on recently talking about Youth Speaks, about the Brave New Voices, reaches thousands of children across the country and gets them involved with poetry. How does Kay feel about Poetry Slam?
Well, I would say that the kingdom of poetry has many mansions, and that certainly slam poetry is one of the mansions. It's not one that I spend much time in, but hey, I'm all for everything that employs lively language, that gets people excited. The kind of poetry that I'm interested in is the kind of poetry that can live on the page and be completely reconstituted in your mind, in your voice, from the page. I'm profoundly engaged in that black and white image on the page. It matters to me.
Well, an emailer asked a while ago, somehow I think we let it slip from view, but poets who have been most influential with you or who have had the most impact on you.
Well, you know, I would think that they've got me dead to rights with Emily Dickinson, in the sense that I, of course, revere her. I would also say, and this is something that I can only confess now that I have achieved this lofty position, I hope I haven't been really influenced by her, but I've just adored Stevie Smith, the hilarious British poet. When I discovered her, I was at City Lights Books, and I found a little volume of her work. And I went next door to the, what's the coffee house next door? Trieste. So I went over there, and I read it, and it was the most thrilling literary experience I'd ever had, to find somebody who was so utterly willful and independent in her thinking. And in what she would do anything. She'd make a fool of herself, and I admired it a great deal. Of course, I love Philip Larkin. I revere Robert Frost. Those are some.
We're going to go to some more calls here in a moment. I just want to go to some emails first, though. It's funny. I was just thinking about. I wonder if you'd agree with this. A friend of mine, Maurice Basson, once said, "You probably can learn all you need to know from reading Emily Dickinson."
Yeah, but you have to know so much to get it out of there.
Well, they said that about Shakespeare, too. Kay, this is Rick in Mill Valley. It says, Kay mentioned she does not write poems in response to specific events or occasions. I thought that was exactly the job of the poet laureate. Can you comment and discuss? And any bicycle poems?
Huh. Well, I don't think that it is in any way the job of the American laureate. The British laureate sometimes has to celebrate public drinking fountains and so on, I think, or maybe larger waterworks. But the American poet laureate has no such requirements.
Here's Josh, who says, Mrs. Ryan, is Miss Ryan, well, I know it's Mrs. Ryan.
Let's say Ms., okay?
Ryan, yeah. Just mentioned that crows are really an important bird. Why? As a poetic device or for some ecological reason? I'd love to know, because I really don't like these birds. Preconceived foreshadowing in practice, perhaps.
Well, I just think they're really important birds. I guess they're important in my life because I see them all the time. I've long worried that they're taking over the habitat of other birds. It kind of shows up in my poem, you know, saying tossing out the sweeter species or whatever it is. But apparently they are not replacing other birds. They are sometimes indicative of a habitat change, but they don't go throwing out the sweeter species. So just another bunch of balderdash in a poem. And they're important because they're ubiquitous. And because their image is everywhere, well, I mean, that's ubiquitous, isn't it? But I mean, their visual image is everywhere in art. They're used a great deal in poetry, and we all have them in our trees.
Well, let's see if we get another call on here. We'll go to Ohio. Michael, join us.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Hi.
This is a fabulous program. I love hearing poets speak about their poetry, and especially love to hear poets read their poetry. My question is this. I've read a number of poet laureates from the United States. One of my favorites was a woman named Maxine Kuhman, and she had written in one of her pieces while she lived in D.C., that poetry makes nothing happen. It lies in the valley of its making. And I wondered if you had a comment about or a feeling towards what you think poetry, as you create it or as it means something for you, what does it mean or what does it make happen?
Yeah, actually, we're just doing a little sotto voce here. It was Auden, right?
Yeah, I think you said that.
Yeah, not Maxine Kuhman, but
Maxine quoted Auden.
Right. Yeah. But the caller's question really is, what does poetry do?
Well, I think the thrilling thing is that it doesn't do anything. I think that there's much too much that's very busy doing things, and I think poetry gives you some relief from the world of usefulness, I am thrilled to say.
It gives you imaginary gardens with real toads in them, as the great Marianne Moore said. Read, in fact, that poem. It's called Poetry. It's a wonderful poem, and so are so many of Kay Ryan's. So good to have you with us, and congratulations again.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
Poet Laureate of the United States, Kay Ryan, our own. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and on hours repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And our interns are Joey Kahn, Shazia Joffrey, Kelly Pretzer, Megan Rollins, and Allison Von Dingelin. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.